This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Marlborough, Hudson, Harvard Stowe, and Bolton. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashland, Bolton, and Harvard. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Community Advocate, Harvard Press, Stowe Independent, Bolton Independent, as well as the Worcester Telegram Gazette and the Metro West Daily News. Today, we will be reading from the newspapers dated May 7th, 8th, and May 9th. This is Arnie Wenske, along with Alan Chapman, reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. We begin with news, information, and announcements for the city of Marlborough. Our first article from the Community Advocate, Governor Healey visits Assabet Valley Regional Technical High School. State providing $3.75 million to expand programs. Marlborough Assabet Valley Regional Technical High School hosted Governor Maura Healey and other high-ranking state education leaders as the governor announced $70 million in funding to support career technical education, known as CTE, at 28 schools, including Assabet. Assabet Valley will receive $3.75 million of the funding to develop two new CTE career technical education programs, including public safety and veterinary science. The new programs are expected to enable Assabet Valley to expand by about 160 students in the coming year. Statewide, the $70 million in additional CTE funding will create up to 2,500 new CTE seats by expanding 23 career technical programs, launching 27 new CTE programs, and updating equipment, technology, and lab spaces. At Assabet Valley, the new public safety program will prepare students for essential roles in public safety and emergency response. The program will include access to a mock dispatch center and forensics lab. It will also include partnerships with municipal fire and EMS departments for internships and work-based learning, and partnerships with community colleges leading to public safety degrees and certifications. The new veterinary science program will prepare students for entry-level roles in animal care and veterinary services. The program will include access to examination tables, grooming tools, and certifications for veterinary CPR and approved veterinary assistant, known as AVAs. Governor Healey toured Assabet with Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, Secretary of Education Steve Zurich, and Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez, met students and discussed what students are learning in the CTE program. Approximately 150 students took part in preparing CTE displays for the governor and state leaders. Governor Healey then announced the new funding at a press conference held in the metal fabrication shop. Assabet Valley Senior Alyssa Silva spoke at the press conference and said CTE helped her find calling in plumbing. Silva credited hands-on learning for preparing her for a successful career and said the certifications and lessons she learned at Assabet Valley have prepared her to become a licensed plumber by the age of 21. Here at Assabet and amongst CTE schools across the Commonwealth, we see every day how rigorous academics paired with high-quality career and technical education prepare students not just for graduation, but also for more than 1,800 hours of experiential learning geared towards achieving meaningful careers and lifelong success. The grant expands capacity, modernizes programs, and ensures more students can access career and technical pathways aligned to workforce demand, from advanced manufacturing and health sciences to information technology and skilled trades, said ASPEIT Superintendent Director Ernest Houle. Today's announcement is more than just about funding. It's a strategic investment in talent development, economic competitiveness, and improving access. We are extremely grateful to the Healy-Driscoll administration and our legislators for investing in tomorrow's workforce today. Across Massachusetts, we're hearing from students and families who want to access career technical education. That's why we're making $70 million investment to expand programs, create new seats, and modernize training facilities so more students can get the skills they need and step into strong, in-demand careers, said Healy. This investment will expand capacity, create new opportunities, and ensure more students can gain the skills they need to succeed while strengthening our workforce and supporting employers across the state. Career technical education is about access and opportunity for our students and our community. By strengthening CTE pathways, we are not only preparing high school students for in-demand careers, but also creating accessible, flexible opportunities for adult learners to reskill, upskill, and advance in today's workforce, said Christine D. Jardin-Gauthier, Director of ASPEIT Community Education. It's been exciting to elevate the importance of this work and even more meaningful to do so with the support of Governor Healy, whose commitment to workforce development and career technical education is making this expansion possible. Our next story from the community advocate, Marlborough's Addiction Referral Center looking for a new home. Addiction doesn't discriminate, neither does Marlborough ARC. The ARC, standing for Addiction Referral Center, sees CEOs, attorneys, and the homeless. Some come in suits and ties, others come in clothes with stains. Some have been coming to the ARC for years, but for some, it could be their first appeal for help. We help everybody and nobody is judged, said ARC Executive Director Mark Vitale. The nonprofit organization, which started as a group of people getting together to support one another through shared struggles, has been people helping people since 1972. In 1983, the ARC incorporated, and in 2006, it moved to Main Street in Marlborough. Today, the organization is looking to move to a larger space. We've outgrown this space. We're in a leased space. We need a bigger space. We have to rent space somewhere else for people to use, said Teresi Gustafson, the president of the board of directors. We just outgrew it, and the need we need to fill can't happen in this space. The ARC is looking for a space in Marlborough or Hudson that has a meeting area capable of holding 100 people. About 300 people per week attend ARC meetings, which include Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, a host of alcohol support groups, and meetings in Spanish and Portuguese. The ARC is active 7 days per week. More space could help the ARC reach even more people who could use support. There's a lot of branches of recovery. 80 or 90% goes to alcohol or narcotics, but we have a gamblers group that I know we could provide more space to. Overeaters Anonymous has many major meetings in the Metro West, but none of them are face-to-face. There's just so much we can expand on if we have the space, said Vital. While there are online and telephone resources available, and the ARC encourages anyone in need of help to seek whatever works for them, the organization has become known for its ability to build personal relationships that keep people coming back for support. We are in the business of saving lives. That first step, it might be the biggest step they've ever made, to come to a room full of strangers and talk about the struggles they're going through. Nobody judges. Nobody minimizes the content of what anybody is saying, said Vattel. He added, one thing I learned, and I learned it very quickly, is that people in recovery are some of the nicest people in the world. If you are looking for help with substance use disorder, call the ARC at 508-485-4357. Once again, 508-485-4357. The organization will help you find a path to recovery. To learn more about the ARC's services or how you can help support this nonprofit, by visiting their website, theaddictionreferralcenter.org. Our next article for the city of Marlboro, the Laudate sisters are helping lead AMSA softball to new heights. Marlboro, for the Advanced Math and Science Academy, known as AMSA, softball team, the left side of the field belongs, or the infield, belongs to the Laudate family. Brooke Laudate, a junior, starts at shortstop for the Eagles. Michaela Laudate, a sophomore, is the team's starting third baseman. If a ball is hit to the infield, it's likely one of the Laudates has it handled, and the sisters are a huge reason why AMSA has yet to be defeated this season. They're both extremely competitive, even against each other, said head coach Jason Ayak. Honestly, it keeps them working twice as hard. Neither one wants to have the other one have a better game. They constantly work. They're simply phenomenal players. Though both sisters also play soccer and basketball, softball is their favorite sport. Brooke was pulled up to varsity as a sixth grader, starting as an eighth grader. It was a similar story for Michaela, who made varsity as a seventh grader starting the next year. Callie, their younger sister, is almost ready to join the Eagles. She is a middle infielder, too, and there's a chance of nearly all Laudate infield in years to come. Competitive as they are, the sisters ultimately support each other. It's really great. Brooke is always there for me, and she gives me great advice when I'm not doing so great, said Michaela. I've learned a lot from her, but in practice, that competitiveness comes through. Michaela would fly across the country to catch the ball to make sure her sister is out, Ayak joked. But their competition pushes one another, and that's good for the team. Sometimes sisters on the team can lead to clicks, but not for AMSA. In a program that has 6th through 12th grade ball players, the sisters serve as an important link between different age groups. Michaela's friends are Brooke's friends. Better uniting the team. It makes the team so much more connected. She's more connected with her grade and younger. But I know the older kids. Us being around the same age brings the team together as a whole, said Brooke. Between club sports, practice, and games, the Laudate sisters spring is chock full of softball. When driving in the car together, typically en route to some softball destination, the sport is frequent point of discussion. But once they're home, we talk about random stuff, Michaela. As far as the on-field play goes, Michaela characterizes herself as more of a contact hitter, while sister always hits the ball far. She said, both make a huge impact on the AMSA team that seemingly can't be stopped. It's all the work we put in over the off-season. All of us do club or some sort of training over the winter, said Brooke. We also hang out over the off-season. So it helps us bond closer. Skill-wise, we all understand each other and how we can improve. And finally, last article for the city of Marlboro, Shaw's to open in Marlboro this month. See when shelves will be stocked. Shaw's and Marlboro is set to open on Friday, May 22nd, according to the press release from RK Centers, which owns the plaza. Hannaford Supermarket previously occupied the space located at 193 Boston Post Road before closing in September. Hannaford did not have the opportunity to renew the lease as its Marlboro store, it told the community advocate at the time. A spokesperson for Shaw's told the community advocate that the store will provide customers with an inviting atmosphere that highlights quality products, variety, convenience, and great customer service. And with that, I will turn it back over to Alan for this brief message.
Yep. And some message, some news from Stowe. Stowe Cafe owners plan for deportation. Those hoping for the release of Stowe Cafe owner Max Fernandez are now taking in an update from a new GoFundMe set up to help the family relocate. The update states that Fernandez will be deported to Brazil and that his family is struggling to raise funds to relocate to that country. Fernandez was detained during an ICE operation on January 28th. Since that time, his wife has worked to keep the restaurant going. Last month, the restaurant was closed by the town of Stowe, leading to some confusion. The closure was due to the town requiring repairs to a stove hood and a venting system that were not working. This new announcement concerns Fernandez's immigration status. Max has begun the relocation process, but progress has been slow, said family friend and the GoToMe organizer, Charlotte Murray, in response to questions from The Independent. He remains at the Plymouth ICE facility for now. Meanwhile, his wife needs additional time to gather the necessary documentation and raise funds to support her and their daughter's move to Brazil. She is aiming to leave in early June, expecting everything to be in place by then. In the GoFundMe, Murray talks about how expensive the legal process has been for the family, and their bills have become a huge hardship as they are concerned about getting special services for their triplet daughters. What they need most right now is financial support to help them return to Brazil and start over, added Murray. If you're able to share their story, promote GoFundMe, or help bring it to the attention of news outlets, it would be deeply appreciated. To learn more about the efforts, see GoFundMe, GoFund.me/7ECFC46E8. An effort has begun at the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton to assist the family, and The Independent will have more next week. A bicyclist was seriously injured in a Stowe crash. A bicyclist was seriously injured on May 4th during a collision with a vehicle at the intersection of Sudbury and State Roads, according to Police Chief Michael Stelis, who said police and fire personnel responded just after 5 p.m. and immediately began life-saving measures. A landing zone was set up at the Massachusetts Firefighting Academy. The victim was transported by medical helicopter to UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, where they were stabilized and in serious condition. The driver cooperated at the scene, and the investigation is ongoing. Future is looking bleak for former gas station. The eyesore across the street from the Stowe Shopping Plaza may remain a fixture for years to come. At the planning board's May 5th meeting, officials signaled that a long-awaited special permit for the former gas station at 124 Great Road is likely to deny the site plan as presented. We are not going to approve it, after more than a year of hearings, deliberations, and repeated offers, Planning Board Chair Lori Clark offered a blunt assessment of the application's standing. "We're very clear we're not going to approve it. When the site's use as a tire-slash-automobile rental business continues to be allowed under the former Lower Village Business District bylaws, the proposed redevelopment calls for a special permit under the newer bylaws due to changes in parking, density, and traffic circulation." Clark explained, she emphasized that nearly every aspect of the plan falls under the jurisdiction of the newer construction bylaws. The board's primary hesitation centers on a potentially unsafe traffic situation. Based on the proposed circulation pattern combined with the volume of vehicles flowing through for several services, members expressed skepticism that a small lot could safely handle the volume of vehicles described in the business plan. The Planning Board's Karen Kelleher stated, "Too much traffic is being crammed into the site." Member John Colonna Romano agreed that the proposal is too intense for the location. While a valet system was proposed, he noted that the cars parked outside would likely block truck access to the rear of the property. "I think that the volume they gave us is not realistic," Clark said. She noted that based on the number of possible services, there could be more than the applicant estimated 8 to 15 cars being served on an average day, making the traffic much for the footprint. Clark further pointed out a practical flaw in the design, noting that arriving customers would have to clear would have no clear direction on where to go when entering the lot. She recalled the applicant telling the planning board customers driving in would need to ask where to go by parking out front and, in most cases, asking inside the office. Clark said the planning board could theoretically approve the special permit should the Zoning Board of Appeals granted the needed variance to allow parking in the front. But this is when she also was firm that given the debate, planning would probably not approve the plan as it stands. The application was submitted by Sam Borgani in 2024, and it's been a source of growing friction. The planning board expressed ongoing frustration with the applicant over months of postponed hearings and a perceived lack of response to information requests. Planning Board Director Valerie Orthuz reported that a final decision must be filed by July 13th. If the permit is formally denied, state law generally requires a 2-year waiting period before an applicant can submit a new proposal for the same site. Volunteers come out for the 17th annual Stowe Cleanup. Organizers of the Stowe Cleanup are applauding the efforts of 178 volunteers who cleaned up more than 52 roads and sections of Stowe. They came away with 155 trash bags, which were collected by the Stowe Department of Public Works. Organizer Jenny Henderson says the most common items found, fast food containers, nips, and cigarette butts. Large items collected, 4 tires, a sofa, a guitar case, and a bed. Didn't say whether that was single or double. Henderson creates Sandy and Tara Taft. They started all this 17 years ago and are still actively participating. She notes, follow the group on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Stowe Cleanup. Separately, the Pine Bluff Beach Cleanup with the Stowe Recreation Department is scheduled for Saturday, June 13th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Randall Library Grand Opening and Ribbon Cutting. The newly renovated Randall Library will officially open on Friday with a ribbon cutting ceremony and a day-long public open house. The Stowe Minuteman Fife and Drum Corps will add to the celebration. A second event focused on children and families is planned for Friday, May 15th from 11 6:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., that's tomorrow, during the district's early release day. A variety of hands-on activities, including games, Lego play, painting a book tote, button, making, and scavenger hunt. The new library director, Ricky Sioris, said reopening represents more than a new building or updated space. It reflects the changing role library plays in modern communities. While books and media remain central, modern libraries are increasingly places to work, meet, and connect without the expectation of spending money. Sirosi said during an earlier interview, "Our role is to balance those needs and remain flexible for whatever new technologies or demand comes along next." He has encouraged residents who have not visited in recent years to explore the library's expanded services, including digital offerings available from home. The Stowe Memorial Day Parade is set for May 25th. The town's Veterans Graves Committee is inviting residents and veterans to take part in Stowe's annual Memorial Day Parade on Monday, May 25th, a longstanding community tradition honoring those who died in military service. The parade is scheduled to begin assembling at 1:40 p.m. on Hartley Road between Center Street and the Hale Middle School, with a prompt step-off at 2 p.m. Participants will march to the Brookside Cemetery, where a ceremony, including speeches and a wreath laying, will take place. While some veterans do choose to wear their uniform, there is no formal uniform required for participation, notes a committee statement. You can simply wear something representing your branch of the service unit, or just comfortable clothes. Veterans who would like to participate but feel the distance is too much are encouraged to contact veterans@stowe-ma.gov. Organizers plan to make vehicles available for those who would like to ride in the parade. If you know of veterans, please invite them to march with us as the release. We would like to get the word out to as many of the town's veterans as possible. Parking will be available on a first-come, first-served basis at the Center School and at the Hale Middle School lots. For those unable to attend, residents are encouraged to observe the National Moment of Remembrance at 3 p.m. Moving over to the town of Harvard, the town election was marked by an extremely low turnout, and it passed the override and debt exclusion. Beginning with a slow trickle that grew unevenly throughout the day, voters on their way to the Hildreth Elementary School gym Tuesday to cast their ballots in the town election. With no contested elective positions, the only suspense was the outcome of the two ballot questions. The $135,370 override for fiscal 2027 omnibus budget and the $800,000 debt exclusion for the Eldridge Road culvert. Both passed handily, according to the unofficial results posted on the town's website. Incumbents Kara Miner and Eric Ward were each reelected for another three-year term on the select board. Abby Bessie was reelected to the school committee, where she will be joined by new member Elizabeth Knees. Gail Coolidge will serve another term as library trustee, and Rebecca Brown will join the board as a new member. Michael Killian was reelected as a trustee for the Warner Free Lecture Board. He receives 461 votes, making him the largest vote getter of the day. And Steve Richter also won a place on the Warner Free Lecture Board as a write-in candidate. Tuesday's turnout was light, but by no means the lowest among recent town elections. 561 people who voted Tuesday is just under 12% of Harvard's 4,776 registered voters. Asked what brought them to the polls, a few voters chosen at random all cited the sense of public duty. A man who was among the earliest to arrive said, "I always vote. Nothing special today. Another man said, civic responsibility. I generally try to vote in every election, one woman said. It feels like the right thing to do. We live here, and we should support the town. We are now going to take another short break for a public service announcement, and when we return, Ani will be back with more news.
Welcome back. The following news is information announcement for the town of Hudson. Our first article, Hudson election results, $7.25 million in school roof repairs greenlit by town. On May 11th, Hudson residents approved a plan to repair or replace roofs at Hudson High School and C.A. Farley Elementary School at a cost of $7.25 million. According to the unofficial vote tally, 1,041 voted to approve the roof work, while 670 were opposed. The debt exclusion will add approximately $97 to the average homeowner's property tax bill, extending for a period of between 10 and 15 years. This was the second hurdle for the roof repair proposal. Voters at town meeting a week earlier offered overwhelming support, with only 3 out of 162 voters voting to reject the roof repairs. At least a half dozen attendees rose to speak in favor of the funding. The approval earned a round of applause. Superintendent of Schools Brian Reagan said the Hudson High School roof has exceeded its expected life and is experiencing system-wide failure, including punctures, failing seams, and leaks that have saturated insulation. The majority of Farley Elementary's 26-year-old roof is in poor condition. The work will include $1 million to restore the roof, the Farley roof, and $6.25 million for replacement and restoration of the high school roof. Patrick Thayer ran unopposed for one open seat on the select board and earned 1,570 votes. A special election will be held in September to fill another vacancy on the board. Approximately 12% of the town's 15,138 registered voters cast a ballot. Early voting and absentee ballots accounted for more than 1,400 of the 1,799 votes counted. Our next article from the Community Advocate, how a Hudson educator mixes baseball and poetry in her literature classroom. Carol Hobbs will be the first to admit that she's no baseball expert. The 20-year Hudson High literature teacher grew up in Springdale, Newfoundland, a town of about 3,000 on the Canadian island's northern coast. Hockey, not baseball, is the particular or popular sport in the region, and Hobbs earned her only sport trophy in another icy pursuit, curling. I am the furthest thing from a baseball athlete you'd imagine, she joked. But despite her relative lack of experience with the sport, Hobbs, who normally teaches Shakespeare and other literary classics, found space for it in her curriculum, and her students have hit it out of the park. Hobbs' unique creative writing initiative that focused on baseball poetry has yielded multiple award winners at the National Baseball Poetry Festival, which comes to Polar Park from May 7th to the 10th. Not a baseball fan, nor do I know a lot about baseball, but poetry I know, says Hobbs. The initiative started when Pam Gemma, National Baseball Poetry Foundation committee member, invited Hobbs students to enter their poems in the youth competition. Hobbs created curriculum based on American baseball literature, beginning with the poem Hot Dog, The Rules by Karen Sharp. The students brainstormed about food at the ballpark, then wrote poems directing the reader on eating ballpark fare. Students also read Casey at the Bat, a classic from Ernest Lawrence Thayer. Hobbs asked herself how she could get students who, much like her, have never been to the ballpark interested in poetry about the sport. Conversely, how could ball players who had never taken an interest in poetry use their words to convey their love of the game? Through thoughtful planning, Hobbs guided her students. This year, nearly her entire eighth grade creative writing class submitted poems, with additional students now participating after Hobbs expanded the curriculum to other classrooms. There's a lot of planning that goes into getting in front of the class. I think a lot of kids think you automatically know it all. Teaching involves outside planning, curriculum planning, but also planning week by week, said Hobbs. Students like Quentin Wytham, whose baseball poetry focused on the national anthem at the ballpark, commenting on what the song conveys about America, especially during times of political strife, had their efforts recognized. Wytham was invited to throw out a ceremonial first pitch at a WooSox game during the festival weekend. An accomplished poet herself, who received the New England Pen Discovery Prize, Hobbs uses her own passion to write as fuel to guide her students. Seeing them take home prizes made her so proud, she said. I write. I love to write. I feel inspired to write, but there's a lot of work that goes into giving feedback on writing. Reading the work of others, getting feedback on my work, is a good inspiration for me when I'm working with my kids, Hobbs said. It makes me a more astute reader. It gives me ideas on how I can advise the kids. With a classroom abuzz about baseball, Hobbs doesn't have to head to the local park or stadium. She's got everything she needs with her students' poems and stanzas. It's been rewarding to combine baseball and poetry and watch students grow, she said. Our next article for the town of Hudson, Sydney Rausch didn't let 12 surgeries stop her from playing softball. Hudson, when Sydney Rausch was born, her fingers were webbed, stuck together, anatomic band syndrome. That's amniotic band syndrome, a rare condition where fibrous strands entangle and restrict blood flow to a developing fetus, had affected the growth of both her hands and one of her feet. As a two-week-old baby, Rausch had her first surgery. As a five-year-old, she had been through five operations, and today she estimates she's had at least 12 procedures, each designed to give her more mobility in her hands. Still, medical experts weren't certain what Rausch would be able to accomplish. They didn't know what I was going to be able to do, she said, but that didn't and couldn't stop Rausch. The 16-year-old sophomore has hardly let her condition slow her down, becoming a leader and significant contributor to Hudson's softball program. None of us know what she's going through, but I have so much respect for her that she never really makes an excuse about it, said head coach Laura Bowen, who has known Rausch for the last 8 years. She doesn't even make it known, just the way she plays, grips the bat, grips the ball. It's incredible. Even with the constant surgeries growing up, Rausch starting softball wasn't even a decision, according to her mother, Lindsay. Her twin brother, Thomas, was ready for baseball, and she quickly and eagerly followed his lead. I wanted to try softball, and I immediately fell in love with it, said Rausch. But Rausch's enthusiasm didn't make the sport come easy. She had difficulty wrapping her hands, which she estimates haven't grown since she was a five-year-old around the softball. When the ball got bigger to start 12U competition, it presented another challenge. It was like I was restarting, she said. Undeterred, Roush kept working, though her shorter-than-average fingers and limited mobility of her growth hand limit the distance she can throw. She's found a role as the team's full-time second baseman. It can be hard to wrap my hand around the ball, but I work through it, she said, and her challenges have turned her into one of the scrappiest and toughest players around. Roush was pulled up to varsity as a seventh grader, starting as an eighth grader on a team that made it to the championship game. This year, Roush, just a sophomore, may be the oldest infielder depending on the lineup. Though her hands are different from those of her peers, athletics have allowed Roush to focus on what makes her similar to teammates, a love of staying active, being a team member, and playing for their hometown. Roush said she relishes every moment of being a Hudson player. When I was younger, kids would always say stuff about my hands, but that's just what kids do. It's normal. I never took it personally, said Roush. My parents told me to ignore them because they didn't know who I was. In softball, it didn't impact how they looked at me as a player. She's my best friend, so it's been great to see her grow from being uncomfortable at 10U softball to now when she's such a big part of her team. Watching her play, you would literally have no idea she's dealing with that. Just her leadership and how she acts. I'm so proud of her, said Liv Connolly, a junior captain. Last year, Roush had shoulder surgery, missing her freshman Hudson softball campaign. Of course, that couldn't stop her either. She is extremely driven. She sets extremely high expectations of herself. She puts herself out there. She's a force to be reckoned with, said Lindsay Roush. Determined, hard-headed, she's a tough chick, and we're really proud of her. For Roush, what's success without a challenge? You have to keep pushing through the hard stuff. You need to know what you're capable of, she said. You can do it. Keep going. Our next article actually comes from the Hudson, Massachusetts Police Department's Facebook page dated May 11th. As we begin National Police Week 2026 on Monday, May 11th, I want to take a moment to recognize the extraordinary men and women of the Hudson Police Department and law enforcement officers across this country who put on the uniform each day knowing they may face danger, uncertainty, and challenges most people will never fully understand. Police work is more than a profession. It is a calling rooted in sacrifice, courage, compassion, and service to others. Every day, our officers answer that call with integrity and professionalism, committed to protecting this community no matter the circumstances. This week is also about the families behind the badge. To the spouses, children, parents, and loved ones who share their officers with us, thank you. Your support, understanding, and sacrifice allow our officers to do the job and allow our department to succeed. You serve alongside them in more ways than most will ever know. To our community, thank you for the continued support you show our department throughout the year. Your encouragement, kindness, and partnership mean more than you realize. We are proud to serve this town and remain committed to earning your trust each and every day. We also honor the retired members who paved the way before us and those who made the ultimate sacrifice in service to others. Their legacy lives on in every officer who continues this mission. This year's Police Week carries even greater meaning as we mourn the heartbreaking loss of Massachusetts State Police Police Trooper Kevin Trainer, who will be laid to rest this week after tragically losing his life in the line of duty. We ask everyone to keep Trooper Trainer's family, friends, and fellow troopers in your prayers during this incredibly difficult time. His sacrifice will never be forgotten. The men and women of the Hudson Police Department are proud to stand beside law enforcement officers everywhere who continue to serve with courage, integrity, and professionalism despite the many challenges of this profession. National Police Week is a time to honor those who wear the badge, support the families who stand behind them, remember those who have lost, and thank the communities that continue to support us. To all those who serve, we thank you, we honor you, and we never forget you. Chief Richard DiPersio of the Hudson Police Department. With that, I will turn it back to Alan.
And we're back with the finish up one final items from the town of Harvard. Neighbors, skeptics reject the solar farm proposal despite projected cost savings. The town of Harvard will not enter into a lease agreement that would have allowed Solar Energy to construct solar panels on the town's farmer gravel pit. Neither will the town's solar overlay district be expanded from 2 to 4 lots. That was the result of a close vote on 3 solar panel related warrants at last Saturday's town meeting. Article 25, which would have allowed the lease to move forward, failed by 14 votes on the required 2/3 vote, which was 178 to 107. The select board subsequently withdrew Articles 26 and 27 from consideration by moving to refer them back to the planning board for study, review, and report. These articles would have added 2 parcels on Stowe Road, the gravel pit, and 32 acres of state-listed wildlife habitat near Interstate 495 to the solar overlay district. The current district consists of contaminated former landfill off of Depot Road and an existing solar farm on Air Road. Debate on the article drew 23 speakers to the microphone and ended after 65 minutes when the question was called by Codman Hill Road resident Jennifer Finch. In the introduction to the Article 25, Energy Advisory Committee Chair Brian Smith said that voting yes would allow the town to take the tax credit that made the project financially feasible and save the town $2.3 million in municipal energy costs over 20 years. He said the project had been scaled back from 3 microwatts on 7 acres to 1.4 microwatts on 4 acres and stripped of its battery storage in response to a butter concern. He assured attendees that the project would be reviewed along the way by utility regulators in Harvard's Planning Board and Conservation Commission. And the Lee brothers were honored as 2025 Citizens of the Year. Jim and John Lee, brothers who grew up in Harvard and whose decades of volunteer service have made them among the most familiar and trusted figures in town, were named Harvard's 2025 Citizens of Note at the town meeting on May 2nd. Select board members Eve Wittenberg read the tribute before a crowd gathered in the Cronin Auditorium at the Bromfield School. Over the years, the citation observed that Jim and John have served on nearly every town body focused on land, conservation, and community stewardship, including the Park and Recreation Commission, Conservation Commission, Open Space Committee, Transportation Advisory Committee, Cemetery Committee, Community Preservation Committee, and War Monument Restoration Committee. Both have served as trustees of the Harvard Conservation Trust and were instrumental in establishing Harvard Park, and continues to advocate this day for recreational opportunities for residents. John Lee is known around town for his gentle mastiffs. His dog, Walden, the report notes, has become a welcome presence at town hall and community events. The two brothers, and perhaps Walden, will be honored with a place at this year's 4th of July celebration. Moving on to Bolton. Bolton voters approve an FY 25-27 budget after debate over school spending. Voters approved the fiscal year 2027 operating budget for the annual town meeting on May 4th, following a lengthy discussion centered on raising school assessments and long-term financial sustainability. Article 4 of the town's operating budget passed by a vote of 103-57. Early warrant articles moved quickly, with Article 1 and Article 2 passing, the latter amended to $14,543. Several subsequent articles were also approved with little or no discussion. Advisory Board Chairman Bob Guerrero presented an overview of the town's financial position, describing a month-long review process conducted by six volunteer members. The committee began meeting in December, reviewing the budget line by line with department heads. The proposed budget is 2.8% increase over the previous year. When accounting for capital items, total expenditures rise by 7.1%. About 89% of Bolton's revenue comes from property taxes, with new property growth adding an estimated $400,000 compared to the typical $200,000 increase seen in recent years. Education remains the largest expense, accounting for 63.4% of the budget, including assessments to the Neshoba Regional School District and Minuteman Regional Vocational Technical High School. The education portion reflected a 3.1% increase over previous years. For a home valued at $865,689, which is the average for Bolton, the town projects a property tax increase of $346 for the fiscal FY27 budget year. Guerrero cautioned that long-term stability depends on maintaining controlled growth, particularly in school assessments. He noted that increases above 3% may be difficult to sustain and could require Prop 2.5 overrides if they reach 4% or higher. National Grid warns of scam calls. The National Grid is warning customers across the state to be vigilant amid a rise in scam calls targeting residents and businesses. In a statement issued April 27th, the utility said scammers are contacting customers and falsely claiming their accounts are overdue, often threatening immediate service discontinuance unless payment is made. In some cases, the callers use spoofed phone numbers that appear to come from National Grid. Company officials say that while National Grid may contact customers about billing or service issues, it does not demand immediate payment through prepaid cards, gift cards, wire transfers, cryptocurrency, or third-party payment apps. Customers are urged to watch for several common warning signs, including threats of immediate shutoff without prior written notice, requests for personal or financial information, demands for unconventional payment methods, and callers who cannot verify account details. National Grid advises customers to independently verify any suspicious communication by calling the number listed on their utility bill, rather than relying on information provided by the caller. Customers should not share personal or financial information during unsolicited calls. Anyone who believes they have been targeted by a scam should hang up immediately. and report the incident to National Grid or local law enforcement. For account verification or questions, customers can contact Massachusetts Electric at 800-322-3223. That's 800-322-3223. Or Massachusetts Gas at 800-233-5325. For gas, that's 800-233-5325. And you can get more information at www.nationalgridus.com. Senior Appreciation Top Select Board Discussion. The Select Board opened with a presentation from the Friends of Bolton Seniors outlining a variety of May events for Senior Appreciation Month. Heather Goodsell of the Council on Aging shared a lineup of events to support social connections and wellness, including a yogurt bar kickoff, a live trombone ensemble, salad bar lunch, bingo for plants, and a historic talk on the 250th anniversary of the United States, a game show-style Tuesday Connections, and community picnic. In response to these efforts, members of the Select Board expressed strong support for both the programming and the proclamation, and Chairman Kate Budyuk thank the Friends of Bolton, seniors, and Council on Aging staff for their continued dedication to the community. Hi, what's your last name again?
Wensky, W-E-N-S-K-Y.
Yeah. The Community News Program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, or either in large print or Braille, call 508-797-1117. Achieved editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.com. This is Alan Chapman, along with I. Wensky, saying thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. I'm Mark Bramhill. I adore cats, especially my own. Her name is Pigeon. But outdoor cats are one of the biggest threats to birds, killing over a billion a year in North America. And indoor-outdoor cats live much shorter lives than indoor-only cats. By keeping Pigeon indoors, we're doing our part to help the birds. And there are plenty of ways to make the great indoors more exciting for your cat. You can arrange your furniture so they can climb on top of a bookcase or shelf and survey their kingdom. You can have a big play session with them each day. And you can give your cat outside time in a way that's safe for everyone.
Yeah, you like to explore?
Pigeon loves to go outside on a leash, smelling all the plants around the house. Or you can even build a catio, or cat patio, which is like a screened-in porch for your cat. I built one for Pigeon, and it is easily her favorite spot. For cats that are already used to roaming the neighborhood, you can cut back on their outside time gradually, or switch to more supervised outdoor time. Making sure your cats are spayed or neutered prevents more stray and feral cats. And you can always commit to having your next cat be indoor only. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more about the difference you can make at birdnote.org.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be, or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even help dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.